completed an assessment for the Canadian government of the sexual assault prevention and healing services available to youth in HRM. Pam is a longtime Shambhala community member and lives in Dartmouth.
Thank you very much. And Sylvia and Carol already make their announcement. Well, welcome everybody. Thank you so much for coming. This workshop today is entitled Community Solutions, a workshop addressing partner and sexual violence. So thank you for spending your Sunday afternoon here. I wanted to acknowledge the people who called me before this workshop to say they think it's a really great idea. They felt too harmed by abuse to actually come today, but they wanted to reach out and say how much they appreciated our being here today. So we are going to distribute or make available the recording from today, and I want them to know that they're included and that they're here in our hearts. So how many people today are here at the Shambhala Center for the first time? A couple of panelists. And Kim. So just a few people, but I think it's maybe worth touching quickly on Shambhala. The point of Shambhala is manifesting enlightened society. So each of us here has the responsibility to do that, to shine that light out. Shine that light of unconditional goodness as we live our lives. And we take as our main living example of doing that our leader, Sakyong Mipham Rinpoche, and his picture is on the right on the shrine. The title Sakyong means earth protector, and it's the Sakyong's job to hold timeless wisdom and then manifest society from that. But how that happens is one relationship at a time, one interaction at a time, person to person. It's manual labor. And that's what creates our social reality. So it's obviously very important to be able to discuss issues like abuse and violence, sexual and partner violence, to Shambhala people. And I'm grateful that the Sakyong and his partner, the Sakyong Wangmo, have been able to ripen our community to the point that we find ourselves here today having this discussion. I very much appreciate the culture of caring and kindness that's been prioritized for all of us in recent years, and that's why we're here. That's why we're able to be here. So when we have a problem or challenge in Shambhala, such as sexual and partner violence, what do? Well, we don't run straight at it and try to tackle it and apply a bunch of band-aids. First, we just be with that. Be with that challenge, be with that obstacle. Be present with that. So that's part of what we're doing today. And we shine a light out toward that challenge, toward that problem whether it's in the form of a person, our own heart, or manifestation of an organization. We just be with that and we shine a light, our natural, unconditional goodness, and then we see what happens. And when we collectively do that, it has a lot of power. So thank you for coming to Shine Light. And I'd like to introduce my partner, Melvin McLeod, who will be moderating today. He is a veteran reporter of the CBC, and for 20 years has been the editor-in-chief of the Shambhala Sun. Thank you.
Test, test, test. That's pretty loud. That's extremely loud. Test, test, test. Test, test, test. Okay, maybe this will not deafen us all. Okay. So, thank you, Pam. I've simply been asked to act as the moderator of this section of this afternoon. And as you probably know, this afternoon is divided into two blocks with a tea break between. After the tea break, there will be a World Cafe in which there will be much opportunity for discussion and contemplation among us. This session right now is really one devoted to education, to learning from people with significant expertise and experience what the current state-of-the-art thinking is, and understanding and techniques of ways to deal with sexism, violence, women abuse, care, protection, and prevention. So this is not a discussion in which we will specifically address anything relevant or specific to the Shambhala community per se. We have three experts here who will inform us about how these issues are currently being understood, viewed, and addressed, and hopefully that will then inform further discussion about that may relate specifically to issues within this community and organization. So this section will consist of a presentation from each of our three experts and a discussion among them of some of the relevant issues. So I will introduce each of them in turn, and they will give a presentation, and I'll begin on my far right with Heather Gaskill, who is a social worker and counselor at Capital Health with extensive experience addressing trauma caused by woman abuse and sexism. She's also a former counselor at the Avalon Sexual Assault Center. She has a master's degree in social work from Dalhousie, and she is an active member and volunteer here at the Shambhala Center.
How close do I have to? Oh, closer than that, apparently. Okay, so quite close, like this close? Okay. Okay, let's see if I can read what I wrote here. So to start with, I guess before I actually say anything about my work or about sexual violence, which is kind of my where I've spent the bulk of the kind of work that I've been doing for my career as a social worker and therapist, I guess I just wanted to acknowledge this issue tends to bring up a whole lot of strong feelings for people in all kinds of different directions. Sometimes they're quite painful, feelings of anger, defensiveness, helplessness, frustration. So I guess I just want to put a plug in for gentleness for ourselves and each other as we're starting to have this conversation. So I'll just put that out there. Oh, is that not loud? I'm still... How's this? Is this better? Whoa. Okay. Can people hear me? Okay, it's not too loud. It feels very loud. Okay. So basically, when I was talking to Pam about starting to speak about this stuff, what I wanted to talk about, I guess, was my experience of working with women and sort of seeing what the current response tends to look like when people are disclosing sexual violence in their communities, based on what people have been telling me in my office. And I guess this will sort of, you know, start out with some, anyway, it's not great news, but anyway, I guess I wanted to say a few things about that. One of them was that sometimes the responses that people get when they disclose sexual violence can feel as traumatizing, or in some cases more traumatizing than the actual trauma itself. So I just wanted to put that out there to begin with, that how people are responded to around this issue has a tremendous impact on what their process will look like from that point on. So it's really, really important. It has a huge impact on people's journey. So I just wanted to say that from the outset. So I thought I would talk a little bit about sort of what those responses look like. So to begin with, there's sort of the general system response, which would be sort of the criminal justice response. So to start with, conviction rates, I mean, I don't have the exact statistics in front of me, but charge rates and conviction rates around this stuff are abysmally low. So there's not actually much of a response in that sense. And the other thing that I would say about that is that, so I started doing rape crisis work as a volunteer when I was 19, and I've been involved in violence against women since then, so that's about 16 years ago now. So I've literally talked to hundreds of women about this, and I would say that I feel comfortable saying that pretty much most of them don't report. It never actually gets to that point. So there's a lot of sort of mythology in society around, you know, people coming forward with allegations and things like that. But for the most part, in terms of women that I've talked to, most of them never go to the police. That, you know, and when I'm having conversations with people like that, people about that in my office, it's just sort of, you know, when I was at Avalon, I would kind of, and I worked at a couple of other sexual assault centers as well, and we'd sort of be having a conversation about that, and that would come up as sort of, you know, informing people about their options. And I'd often get these responses from women being like, why would I do that? How do you figure that that would be helpful to me? No one will believe me about this. Why would I expose myself to that experience of, you know, people responding in that way? People have this sort of visceral kind of understanding of that. I mean, there are exceptions to that, and I've also, in my work, accompanied people a lot through the process of going through the process of going through the system and things like that. When I was working in Newfoundland with the Canadian Association of Sexual Assault Centers, I was involved in a research project called the Lynx Project, which actually was national, and we watched women who had come forward to the system go through the process and what that looked like. And it tended to be a very difficult process, and there tended to be a strong scrutiny on the behavior of the person who was bringing forward this allegation. There was a lot of focus on her and what she did or she didn't do. And that tends to have a strong influence on how people experience, how people are processing this stuff. So, there's a system piece. There's also my listening to stories about how families, communities, partners, friends respond to this stuff. And largely that response is, unfortunately, can be quite difficult as well. I would say I feel totally comfortable making the statement that I feel like as a culture we are profoundly uncomfortable with this topic, profoundly. And so I think that, you know, when these things are brought forward, there's often strong feelings of Anger and fear and paralysis, I think, are the three sort of words that I would use when I, you know, as I'm thinking about responses that people have talked to me about, you know, from their families, friends, that sort of thing. Not in every case, but that's a, it's sort of a broad, anyway, that tends to be the broad general response that people talk about. And so, and there's also, again, in that situation, a kind of like, particularly, I work with tons and tons of, I've worked with tons of women who have experienced childhood sexual abuse, and there's a kind of, you know, there's kind of a shoot the messenger kind of thing that happens in terms of, like, both in families and communities, in terms of, why are you doing this to us? Why are you bringing this forward and making it difficult for everybody? Why can't you just cope with this on your own? This is your issue. And so I work with all these folks who have had these terrible things happen to them, and they end up feeling like it's an individual, it's their issue. They come to counseling, they're going to deal with it individually, away from community, away from anything else, right? This is mine, I have to cope with it, it has nothing to do with anything else. And so how that ends up coming into play in terms of individual work with people is that the sort of bread and butter of this practice, that the biggest issues that I work with people on around sexual violence are shame and self-blame. Those are the biggest pieces, which I find is fascinating, given that this is, there are all these folks who've had this, you know, horrendous thing that's happened to them, and they come in, and what they're saying to me is, you know, they're telling me these stories, and the story is all about what they didn't do, how they didn't prevent it, why they deserved it. I mean, these are very strong statements when you think about that. This is how people are responding to this. This is the work that we're doing in therapy around this stuff, which is, anyway, quite painful. So, and the other thing is, so there's that piece. Anyway, so you spend some time working with people around the self-blame stuff, but then oftentimes once that shifts, if we can sort of get people to the place where it's all like, oh, it wasn't my fault and I didn't bring this on myself, then there's a larger question which kind of arises in therapy, which is just kind of like, so why didn't anyone speak for me? If I actually have basic worth and I didn't deserve this and this wasn't my fault and I didn't bring it on myself, then what is this world that I live in where nobody has spoken for me, no one protected me, no one was willing to stand for me? And so anyway, that's usually a place in the process where I don't have an answer for that. And I guess that's what I'm doing here, is we need some help. You know? So that's so I just, you know, and in this I'm just looking at my notes here. So I guess that's the thing, when I, because I think about causes and conditions, right? We're the spiritual community, we look at this stuff, right? You know, and I'm interested in pointing out, you know, this response that tends to be the typical way of, and I don't think there's malice aforethought oftentimes in terms of these responses. That's the other thing that I wanted to say, is that I don't think there's a maliciousness, or in terms of like, we really want to shut this down, we want to attack these people, or that, you know, that kind of thing. I think that, you know, people struggle with how to cope with this and how to look at this conflict and how to address it. And, you know, we just sort of freeze, I think. And I guess what I want to say about that is that freezing has a real consequence. It's strong. And it has a massive impact on people. And I, you know, I'm a Shambhala Buddhist, and I, you know, I'm a strong you know, I strongly have this faith in this idea of luminous emptiness, this basic goodness, right? And I just, these responses that we have to people, they have a really strong message to send them about worth. And I think that's really important that we're aware of that as we are moving forward and thinking about how we're going to respond to people when they're coming forward with these stories, is in terms of like, how I respond, what is that saying to this person about how much they're worth? So I just really want to say that. So the other thing too, in terms of as a community response, and I was gonna watch the time, and I haven't been. How am I doing?
I think this point that you're now making will.
This will be the last point. Very well. Okay. So the thing is, the thing I want to say in terms of an actual community response, given that we kind of make this an individual issue for women, they are left to make choices that are not fair. For instance, I'm going to choose between my emotional and physical safety and having family and community. I am going to have to choose between being comfortable in my environment and being able to be around people and be at my job or at school or whatever. I have worked with tons and tons and tons of women who have had to make the choice in terms of, okay, so I'm in this situation, I've disclosed, no one is supportive, so I can either leave all of these pieces that are important to me that I want to continue to with, or I can stay with it and be in a situation where I feel really unsafe. And I don't think that's a fair decision for people to have to make. Those aren't good options. They're not. There's no fair option there. And so I guess I'm interested in creating a community where people don't have to make that decision. And in fact, it's not even their decision to make. I think it should be us as a community deciding, we got a problem here, and you know we're going to address it because it's sort of like a safety hazard, you know, like a we're going to have to deal with it as opposed to making it an individual issue, which is kind of how it goes now. And I'm going to stop talking because I think I'm probably over. Anyway, so that's these are my initial thoughts.
Thank you very much. That was excellent. Our next presenter is Lori Ehler in the center here, who is the executive director of Bryony House, which is the largest transition house in Nova Scotia, serving women and children who are exiting abusive situations. Lori is also the former director of the Elizabeth Fry Society of Nova Scotia, which serves women criminalized in the justice system. These are obviously both very significant positions in the social service network here in Nova Scotia, serving women and families. So we're very pleased that you could take the time to join us. Thank you.
I'll do my mic test now. Okay, great, thanks. I usually am good at projecting my voice, so I'll try my best. Thank you. I'm really happy to be here. I think it's fantastic to be able to talk to a group who is interested and want to address the issue. Also, I have great colleagues in the the room who have done brilliant work working for women and their families to address violence against women issues, and also have a colleague in the room, Guilhemina, who works with me and has been so for many, many years. So it's always nice to have colleagues and supporters in the room who believe in the work that we are all trying to do. So I just want to put that out there. Bryony House is a women's shelter for women and children fleeing intimate partner violence here in HRM. We have approximately really 32 beds, so we have the capacity for about 32, but we try to hold it at 24 because of the intense issues that we often have in the families and the complexities of the issues when they come in through our door. There is no real cookie cutter model for women coming in. They come from all social economic backgrounds, all cultural backgrounds. The only thing that they often have in common is they're leaving intimate partner violence. Women may have children or they may not have children. The one thing that we all try to do is really validate their experiences, validate their feelings, and try to eliminate the shame and the self-blame and taking on the self-responsibility, because us as a culture continue to say things like, why didn't she leave? She complains about it. Why didn't she leave? And that is such a loaded question. It's never easy. And often women will talk about it at the shelter, will say, people will ask, why didn't you leave? And the women will respond, it was safer for me to know where he was. It was safer for me to know that I knew where he was in his cycle of violence. Because if I didn't, I was more at risk to be harmed if I didn't know where he was in two of those, in physical location, but also psychological location of the wheel. So it's much more complex than that. Women want their children to be safe. Women want themselves to be safe, but they want the relationship to be healthy. They want to love the person they fell in love with. But they just don't want the violence. They want the violence to end. So often women will continue to hang on to the hope that we can fix this relationship, we just need to change the pattern of behavior. One of the statistics is that 1 in 4 women will experience intimate partner violence in their lifetime. So if we just look around the room, statistically, there's a lot of women who have experienced violence with a partner in this room. So it's not something that is individualized. And we often, unfortunately, will ask, again, why didn't she leave? And, oh, she's back for the fourth time. Why doesn't she stay away? And I keep asking the question, why does he continue to be violent? We need to start changing the questions. We need to start changing the focus and looking at the broader context and the kind of systemic things that are happening in our community. And the same thing with sexual violence. Oh, well, wasn't she asking for it? Look at the miniskirt she wore last night. And, oh, she was walking down the street at 2:30 in the morning. What did she expect when she was sexually assaulted? Again, we as women should feel, and men should feel, it's safe to walk down the street at 2:30 in the morning wearing whatever we want to wear. It's the question of why does the violence continue? And we're not talking, when we come in, women come into the shelter, we have women from all over the world that sit in our shelter, and they can't speak English. Their children have experienced incredible trauma. It's just, but the expectations are very different. So we have cultural norms that have shaped how gender violence exists in our community. We look at music, we look at music videos, it's everywhere, magazines, the sexualization of women and young girls, it's all over the place. So we continue to create violence in the expectation or the acceptance of how we see and portray women in our communities. I want to be clear from my perspective that I think sexual violence and intimate partner violence is really about power control more than it is about the actual act of violence. That is just completely my perspective, but it's often, and that is often the most dangerous of violence, is the control and the power that one needs in their relationship. When women leave their violent relationships or just their controlling relationships, the most danger comes in stalking, the threats to kill, the threats to kill them, their partner, their pets, the family pets. That is about control and about the need to have power and control in that relationship. And so we can need to start looking at ourselves and stop individualizing, which we do, because that's the courts demand it, our continued asking questions about why didn't she leave, what about her children, didn't she love her children. It continues to allow people to, again, look at it and shame, blame, and continue to internalize that responsibility. Many women come into the shelter and they talk about, I have a university education, I should have known better. And, or I have a high paying job, I should have known better. I should never have gotten myself into this situation. But it's never, violence is never one act. It's never one single act. It is a continuum of actions that get us to a point of being in a situation of violence against women. So, of course, only if that's true in an intimate partner relationship, certainly not in a incident of sexual violence, oftentimes. So I just want to put it out there that certainly it's a long culture, long history of accepted cultural norms that continue to perpetuate in society. And so so when we talk about how can we change this, our strategy has to be about looking at a bigger picture and not individualizing and not trying to fix. We at our shelter try to fix individuals because that's all we can deal with. But when we walk into the community perspective, we try to look at a bigger role, a bigger analysis, and a more less gendered but a community response. And one of that, from my perspective, is certainly having men help in that voice. Changing men's violence against women is what we need in our community, to be men taking part in that and helping us get that voice out there. And that's happening. That's happening in our communities for sure. But we need more of that. Our judgments and our statements continue to isolate and blame and individualize violence. And our doing that continues to allow the silence to exist. And as long as that happens, the violence will continue. So there's just no way around it. When we breathe the silence and we encourage the silence, then we allow the violence to continue. And so when we ask those questions, why didn't you leave? Why don't you continue to leave? If someone comes to you and feels that you're a confidant and a friend and trusts you and tells you what's been going on, and then all your question is, well, why don't you leave? Then the next time, they're probably going to be more guarded in telling you about the situation that's just happened in the home. We need to change our language to say, Whenever you need me, I will be here. Whenever you choose to leave, we will be here. I will be a part of your safety plan. How can we set up a safety plan for you so you can make a choice when you need to leave? I will be here even if I don't hear from you for a year. I will still be here. I will still love you. I will still support you. Because when we say the language, why didn't you leave? You're telling the woman that you blame her for not leaving. You blame her for being in the violent situation. And so when we offer that up as a blame, we continue to build up the bricks that build a very strong wall. And then women become very isolated, and then the only person in their life is now the abuser. And so they have nowhere to go. They have no one to talk to about this, and the isolation just continues to grow. So it's really important for us, when women come to us, no matter how many times women come into the shelter, we have women who've been here 10, 11, 12 times. When they come to us and say, I think he's changed, I'm going to return, all we can do is say, what we ask, what has changed? We help them create a safety plan and always say, we will be here if you need us. It's never about judging them. And I can tell you in the years that I've been there, I've been at Bryony House for 7 years, and 5 women have been murdered by their partners in the time that I've been there. And so it happens in the community. And a woman last year was murdered from her partner, and the day that she was murdered, that day she said, I don't think he'll kill me, I'm going to go home tonight. And she was murdered that night. So women never believe they're going to be hurt. Women never believe they're going to be murdered by their partner. Women just believe that they want to be loved and they want their relationship to be okay, because they have an intrinsic value in making it work. Also, we have to be really aware that children intervene in these relationships. We'll often hear moms say, oh, no, but they were asleep. But women need to understand their children are intervening and are witnessing this violence in many, many, many different ways. So it's important for us to just think about things and how we do that. I know I'm running probably out of time, but I can go on forever. So, my biggest thing certainly is just to say that we as community members need to stop imposing our own judgments, our own expectations, and our own statements, so we can create a very open way to protect women, to create a very open way to allow women to make decisions. And I understand and I know that males experience domestic violence as well, but our work is with women, so that's kind of where I'm coming from on this. But we need to keep it open, keep our dialogue open, keep it supportive. I have lots of people who say to me, he beats her until she's in a coma, and then she comes out of the hospital and goes back to him. I can't have it anymore. I'm so angry with her for returning. And then so the isolation just continues. So again, we need to put the judgment aside and just say, I love you. I will be here for you. I will help you every step of the way when you're able to make that decision. And then that will at least help us stay in her loop and stay in her frame of mind when she's ready to go, when she's ready to leave. So that will be just my starting point. So, sorry.
Test, test, test.
Okay. So, thank you very much, Lori. Our final presenter for this portion is Becky Atkinson, to my immediate right. And she was the project coordinator, researcher, and writer on the legal guidebook, Safely on Your Way, Child Custody and Access Information for Women Leaving Abusive Relationships, which was published by the Legal Information Society of Nova Scotia. Motivated by her own personal experiences, Becky wrote the guide to support other women facing challenges similar to what she went through. Battery is dying. Unless I'm just she will speak, you will speak, about the role of community in her own journey to safety.
Thank you.
I'd like to start just by saying it's been several years since I have been involved in this subject. But when Pam called to invite,
I think we need it louder. I think since folks in the back are not.
It feels really close.
I'm not much of a presenter, so I need to read what I'm going to say. When Pam called to invite me to speak today, I had a really strong feeling that I should, and I wasn't really sure why that was until I started to write. So the title of what I wrote to read to you today is borrowed from Leonard Cohen. It's called How the Light Gets In. My community once spanned three provinces, three towns, and a city. It included police officers, victim services counselors, lawyers, friends, family, neighbors, advocates, activists, small business employees, family resource center staff, mental health and medical professionals, community services, caseworkers, and others. Over a five-year period, that community helped move my daughter and I from a situation deemed high risk for lethality to relative safety and stability. These are some of its members. A little nervous. Donna. I am curled up on the floor of my apartment. While the baby is asleep and her father is out, I call my friend Donna in Vancouver. She is a world away. Because the phrase domestic violence has never occurred to me, I have no context for what I am about to disclose. All I have is fragments of rages, threats, isolation, fragments of violence, control, and crazy making. Donna has no more experience with domestic violence than I do, so after we hang up, she calls a national helpline and describes my situation. When she phones back, she tells me the professionals say it is acute classic abuse that is escalating, and I need to leave as soon as possible. Donna sends money to help me escape. Constable Cox. I am sitting in my new apartment after a phone call with him. He's in a rage and threatening to come over and smash my head through the wall. I don't want to involve the police. I don't want him to be arrested, but I don't know what else to do, so I call the OPP just to ask if someone can please stop him from coming. Greg Cox is the officer who answers the phone. He's very calm when he says, "What is happening to you is not okay. It is not okay that you are scared like this." It is because of Constable Cox that I eventually agree to give a statement to the Ontario Provincial Police. My downstairs neighbor. The woman who lives in the downstairs apartment is a hairdresser. She has a husband and a daughter. She is friendly and kind. Each day she brings me a plate of food, a portion from her family's meal. I thank her, but I don't understand this gesture because I have no idea how emaciated I have become. The woman at the cabin. He doesn't stop, even after the police arrest him. Instead, he takes my vehicle so that I can no longer work and follows me wherever I go until I have no choice but to leave the new apartment. We go to stay in a cabin in the woods near the golf course where my stepfather used to work. One evening, a woman comes in and sits down at the table. I don't know her, but she has heard about us. She tells me she understands that she was once in a similar situation. She wants me to know that there is light on the other side. Barb and Jack. After I have fled to Nova Scotia with my baby girl, an Ontario family court judge awards her father sole custody. He makes the ruling in my absence to teach me a lesson about what he calls parental kidnapping. Despite a criminal no contact order, the judge gives him permission to come to my house to take the baby. I have no lawyer, so we go into hiding. Barb is the victim services manager in Ontario. She She says this is the worst case of injustice she has witnessed in her career and calls everyone she can think of to try to help us. Within a few days, an experienced family court lawyer called Jack takes my case on pro bono. Jack stops the court order. The King Street Family Resource Center. This place is my refuge. I bring my daughter here every day, even on the days without programs. Nobody knows what's going on. They think I am a normal mother. But then one day I have no choice. One day when my little daughter is asleep, I pull her stroller up the front steps and into the communal kitchen. The center director is there, along with a program leader and a woman who teaches parenting classes. I sit down at the table and tell them everything. I tell them he has followed us to Nova Scotia and he has just threatened to slit my throat. They stay with me during the police interview. They let me use the phone and the fax and the photocopier to deal with lawyers and police and victim services. They are discreet, and they continue to treat me like a normal mother. Corporal White, we are sitting at the same kitchen table in the King Street Center. After he has interviewed me, Gary White looks right into my eyes and says, "I can see how scared you are, and I want you to know that I believe you." Suzanne, he has secured an aggressive Halifax family lawyer and applied for sole custody of our daughter. Since we now live in Nova Scotia permanently, Jack can no longer represent me. And without a lawyer, we are unspeakably vulnerable. The constant threat of losing my daughter to someone I believe will harm her makes it difficult to function, difficult even to breathe. I hear about Suzanne from the United Church minister, Reverend Joanne. Suzanne is a lawyer at Dalhousie Legal Aid. She has so many cases she has to work through the night on a regular basis just to keep up. Despite her caseload, Suzanne accepts me as a client on a legal aid certificate that ultimately covers a tiny fraction of the hours and years it will take to reach a final court order. Suzanne stays with us, stands by us until the end. Carrie. It is right after a criminal trial where he was found guilty of cracking a wall with my head. I am in my apartment above the Whirligig bookstore. Carrie is there with her two young daughters. She's been looking after my daughter while I testified. All of a sudden, he is outside in the street, out of his vehicle, screaming up at me, "You fucking cunt." I call Corporal White because he has given me his cell phone number just in case. Carrie stays. Within minutes, Corporal White comes and tells me to leave my apartment and go somewhere safe until they can rearrest him. Carrie takes us home with her. I learn later that Carrie's family is concerned for her safety. They don't want us in her house. But Carrie gives us her spare room and never once mentions her family's concerns. Kim. My daughter and I are in a transition house in Yarmouth with no way to get back to Shelburne. I met Kim at the baby group at the King Street Center. I've only known her a short time, but I call her because I don't know what else to do. There is nobody else. Kim doesn't hesitate. She says she will drive right to Yarmouth to get us, even though it's an hour away. Before I hang up the phone in the transition house office, Kim says, "Hey, Becky, thanks for calling." Matt. Matt is the owner of Grovestine's Deli. He gives my daughter tiny ice cream cones on sunny days. Matt heard him that time out in the street and knows he is not allowed near me. So when he passes his vehicle on the highway heading west towards Shelburne, Matt turns his car around to follow and calls to warn me. Matt is the kindest man I know, my daughter's future stepdad, father of her future baby sister. Phil. I am in a room off the courtroom waiting to give evidence about the day he parked outside the Whirligig bookstore and screamed up at my window. There's a crash, and I think there has been an explosion, but it is him. Someone tells me he is smashing up the holding cell in the basement. I cannot stop shaking, and Phil puts his heavy RCMP jacket around me. When we go into the courtroom, the RCMP officers sit in a row directly in front of the witness box so that I can look at them, not him or his lawyer, while I testify. Dawn and Jackie. I am in the income assistance office. The rules say Dawn must contact my daughter's father to request child support so that it can be taken dollar for dollar off my income assistance payment. This would give him access to us, increase our vulnerability. The prospect terrifies me, but I don't say so. I don't have to. Dawn processes the application and tells me not to worry. He isn't going to contact her father. Jackie is my employment support worker. I tell her I want to write a family law guidebook for other women in my situation, but I need some help with the gas to get to Halifax, and I need to be able to stay on income assistance while I work to secure project funding. Jackie is an artist. She sees outside the box, and within a year, I'm off income assistance and working full time. Pam. Bryony House gives me the number of a woman called Pam Rubin who will know how to get my book project started. 2 years later, when the book is almost written, the ground gives way. My daughter is assaulted by her father during an unsupervised court-ordered access visit. She comes home with his teeth marks in her tiny arm. I contact Child Protection, and a young social worker investigates but says there is insufficient evidence to find my daughter at risk. Suzanne tells me I must send her on the next visit because without Child Protection, there are no legal grounds to refuse access. I call Pam, who is on my book steering committee, and she does what I can't do. She contacts the head of Child Protection and describes the madness of our situation. Pam is our advocate. She expresses the outrage that good victims must never express. The head of Child Protection looks into the file and orders another investigation. This time, an experienced social worker reaches a different conclusion. She finds that my daughter was assaulted and is at risk of emotional and physical harm by her father. Because Pam is a warrior, I never have to send my daughter on another unsupervised access visit. Kevin and Mark. Someone had given me a secondhand tricycle. Didn't need much. Just a couple of wheels. Kevin is the soft-spoken man at the Napa Auto Parts store. He didn't have what I needed, but thought his brother Jerry might have some wheels kicking around. He did, but before I could make it up to Jerry's place, the tricycle, which I had left at the King Street Center, was accidentally thrown out with the garbage. A week later, we are walking along Water Street when Kevin's co-worker Mark calls us over. And he and Kevin present my daughter with a brand new red and white tricycle, all decorated with Napa stickers. We aren't all bad, Mark shrugs. As I watch my daughter cycling down the sidewalk, I know that I will never part with this red and white tricycle. Five years of dealing with the criminal court, the family court, and child protection left me with little confidence in the ability of institutions, alone at least, to support or protect women and children in cases of domestic violence. What I do have confidence in is people. One of the many exquisite gifts of those torturous years is the deep faith I now have in the immense power and potential of human goodness. For me, this goodness was more protective than a court order, more cathartic than a victim impact statement. Goodness seeps through cracks in institutions, ignores roles, bends rules, and nudges us beyond our comfort zones to make space for kindness, courage, and generosity. That's how the light gets in. Thank you.
Thank you. I know that wasn't easy for you, nor for any of us. And I know it's not easy for you to have written that and to relive it. And yet you've actually made clear what's at stake in this conversation, and at the same time, the power of a community, people of goodwill and courage and knowledge to make a difference. Thank you very much. So we have a little less than half an hour before we take a break and then go to the next portion of this program. And turning now to all three of our presenters, there are many, many questions which I could pose. I was given an extremely impressive list. But I think the place that I would like to start is with the question of believing. So there are many anti-violence organizations that are offering the message, start by believing. And yet I think many people in many communities find themselves caught in not thinking that they don't know what really happened when they hear a story of violence or sexual assault or abuse. Communities can divide over who is at fault, what happened and what didn't happen. So, and that's often the first barrier to anything positive happening, I would think. Mm-hmm. So how do we as individuals, how do we as a community respond when we first hear a woman saying that she was abused? And this is open to any of you, certain to discuss among yourselves.
Wow, I'm still kind of emotionally still thinking about Becky's presentation. So, I think for everyone who reports sexual violence and intimate partner violence, that first response will really shape what she decides to do, I believe, and what she decides not to do. And so when women particularly that we work with, if people say, I don't believe you, oh, he's not that bad. We have a lot of families who are trying to say, go back to him, he's sorry, he'll never do it again. You're shaming our family by leaving him. What we're again saying is they're worthless, and that they're not worthy of our love and trust, and they're not worthy of having something different in their lives. So I think it's important for us in those moments to validate how they're feeling, to validate how horrible that experience must have been for them. Regardless, again, I think it's about us putting our judgments aside and removing whatever those initial thoughts come in and just providing a safe space to have a conversation, for allowing them to talk it through, and just for them to have moments of feeling that someone believes their story and someone will support them in whatever they need to do. You know, usually those initial times will really frame how a woman's going to move forward or how a man's going to move forward in what they're going to do. So I think for us, just believing, absolutely believing and offering safe space to have some conversation, and it's just a very initial thing that we can do, but it's one of the most crucial things that I think we can do.
Thank you. Heather, would you like to say something?
Sure. I think our culture has some really clear ideas about what sexual violence looks like and who gets victimized, and I think our cultural ideas about that are not at all reflective of what the reality actually looks like. And that tends to have a really strong effect on how people are responded to when they're bringing forward their stories. You know, there tends to be a kind of like, I was walking in a dark place at night and someone jumped out of a bush and I didn't know them and they left me very physically wounded and I went straight to the police and I was hysterically crying, and that's what a rape looks like. And that is not usually what a rape looks like, or what sexual violence looks like. Sexual violence usually happens between people who know each other, and usually people are assaulted by someone who is in a position of trust, who they trust, which is, of course, if you were thinking about assaulting someone, it sort of stands to reason. You would probably, it's much easier to carry that whole thing out if that person has trust in you, if they feel like you're okay, if they feel like if you're in their space, that's all right. So anyway, there's that piece. When we hear stories about what that looks like in terms of, so wait, you had a relationship with this person or they're a family member or that sort of thing, they can really strong, we have these ideas about what sexual violence tends to look like, and then when we hear what the story is from someone, we're thinking that doesn't match up with what I know about this or what I feel like I know about this, and we usually have a strong response to that. The other thing is that there's this piece around, you know, this tendency. Most prevention messages are, you may notice, you probably have some sense of this, most prevention messages around sexual violence are targeted at victims, right? It's kind of like, what did you, here's what you need to do, here's what, this is your job to prevent this or to be aware of it or that sort of thing. Anyway, so there's a real strong scrutiny on the behavior of the person who experiences it. And so we have an idea of what appropriate behavior is and what not appropriate behavior is. And the other thing is, you know, there are things that make people more vulnerable to sexual violence, but that also usually end up serving to discredit them when they come forward, right? I think I know her. I think she's got some mental health issues, you know? I think I understand that she has some issues with addiction, or, you know, I'm aware that she's been around a lot, you know? And so those things end up serving as discrediting someone when actually they make them much more vulnerable and make them a much easier target for someone, you know, in terms of if someone's going to victimize someone, there's often a sense of kind of like, ah, okay, so who is not going to be believed or taken seriously with this? Who can I pick that's going to make it, it's going to be a much sort of more straightforward thing for me? And you can see that in populations of women that experience exponentially more violence, right? Like the stats around Aboriginal women in our culture, right? That's kind of... So anyway, so I guess when we're hearing stories, I guess part of that, I think the most important thing is to start to examine our own bias about what our expectations are about what we're going to hear and what we feel like is reasonable or what things look like versus what they actually look like.
You, Heather, you raised the issue of what I would call in the end prevention, in the sense of a community sending out messages, having values, having the kinds of relationships to create an atmosphere in which sexual and partner violence is less likely to rise. And I'd like to preface this question by saying that all three of you either have lived or work with what we would consider to be very extreme cases. Yet, at the same time, a community may be dealing with an entire range of forms of violence and abuse, many of which may be less clear-cut or graphic or extreme than what you are all dealing with professionally, and yet ultimately still fall within the same area in which the same problems arise. So what does a community do not only to make victims feel safe and cared for and protected and to protect the community, but in the end, to create an atmosphere which lessens the likelihood that men will feel free or empowered to be violent or abusive or domineering.
Well, that's a big question, isn't it? We certainly deal with a wide range of issues at Briny House. Women don't come in who have had physical injuries. So we deal with women who have experienced economic oppression, or we have emotional. Women are called stupid. You're never a good mother. And some women have come in who've never experienced physical harm in terms of physical injury. And often women will come in and say, I know I probably don't qualify to be here. And then we just ask them, why do you think that? So it's not just physical violence. We look at all violence that oppresses. And so when we talk about intimate partner violence, we talk about all the scope of violence. So it's we're not talking about just physical injury or physical harm. So we have a wide range for us. Again, I think it's about having conversations. When we talk about it, we open people up to having conversations. We talk about it, we open understanding. And then when we have conversations, we can see where people are sitting and their understanding, and we have opportunities for education. When we do not allow people, or when we try to stifle an environment that allows those talks to happen, that's when we encourage the violence to continue. And so I always say violence or silence equals violence or contributes to violence, because I really do believe that when we don't talk about it, when we allow the stereotypes to continue, when we allow how women are treated or how violence is treated in the community, when we don't have dialogue, then it just sits silent. So we allow the continuation of it to take place and to rise. So for me, I certainly think we just need to start putting it on the table and having conversations and being okay with those conversations. They might be completely uncomfortable. They might challenge where we sit, what our thought is, but they're still at the end of the day, it has to take place. And we all need to be a part of that conversation. The women's movement certainly has spent years educating, working, policy development, and those have brought us to an incredible place today. But we still have a long way to go, unfortunately, because we still see a tremendous amount of violence happening. We have a lot of women in the community who are very young. You know, we have a higher violent rate right now with ages 12 to 14 to 16. So I think we need to have conversations and be okay with that when we don't have common opinions. But just to be a part of the dialogue is important for us.
Becky, in your incredibly moving description, you described a community, one that was an impromptu community that came together around supporting you rather than a community that was already formed in some sense. But what would you say were the common qualities of all those people you described that brought them together as a community so that they could support you and help you? What among them collectively should we emulate?
I guess one thing I should say is that there's a whole other list of people.
Could you speak more closely to the mic, please?
Or vice versa.
That there are... I ran into all kinds of individuals who were also very harmful. So what I find miraculous is that on reflection, what I know 100% to be true is that the people who stepped forward, that the impact of that and the power of it to make a positive difference for us, so much stronger than any sort of negative intent, any negative influence. And I guess what I see is people both within institutions or systems and in the community, it wasn't necessarily people doing their job, it was when people often stepped outside of their role, bent rules, did something that was outside of their comfort zone, and the only way I can understand it is that it's these stunning moments of humanity when people just do and are good. It's just kindness. And we're blessed with them.
Hard to follow that, Becky. I mean, would you like to say something, Heather, about how a community can create an atmosphere in which problems are lessened or do not arise?
Yep, I can say something about that, which is just, I mean, it's pretty straightforward, but I think it's the most important thing is that we can respond. When someone comes forward, we need to respond, we need to do something when that happens. Which I know sounds obvious, but it doesn't happen, or oftentimes it doesn't happen. So to take it seriously and not to minimize it, as in it didn't happen the way that you said that it did. I'm not really sure that that's, you know, not to be asking a lot of questions around that, but just to go, okay, so to have it, you know, just the acknowledgement that this is actually an issue, that it's actually happening, that it does happen and it happens in our community, I think would be a huge leap. Because I think, and you know, I see this in microcosms of families, like, no, this doesn't happen in our family. No, this did not happen the way that you said that it did. And you see it on a larger scale in communities. No, this doesn't happen. So it couldn't be what you're saying, right? So, and if there's no acknowledgement, there's no possibility of a response without first starting of like, yes, this happened, okay, and so what are we gonna do about it? So.
We've been talking about how the community can help and affect positively victims of violence or abuse. Let's turn the question around and say, on one hand, what effect does it have on the community itself when it denies or sweeps under the carpet or does not help those who need help? And then conversely, what does a community feel like and look like when it does those things properly and does value and care for and trust and believe women and children? What does a community look like that's doing these things right?
We have an order.
Yeah, it seems we have an order now. When communities, I'll start with don't respond, because that seems to be the name of the game these days. When employers are not supportive, it becomes about this is an intrusion. So when the partner is coming to work, stalking her at work, and it becomes more of an intrusive environment for work, then the woman gets fired, or the woman is asked to leave, or woman is asked to take care of it. Women and oftentimes will have to leave their employment or take leaves from their employment because of the situation, which means also women end up on social assistance. So someone may have had a really good job or had been in an environment for quite some time. They had a lot of support there, and all of a sudden they're now with no job, and the supports are gone. Who are the people who every day provide that? So that is an often reality of the women that comes into the shelter. When employers in the community respond well, then women can continue to be supported by their colleagues at work, their friends in the community. They're able to keep their jobs. The employer puts a peace bond or a property protection order in place that gives her a message or him a message that who we care for and what we want to do to make it okay for you to be at your workplace. We are standing behind you, we are standing with you, and helping you in whatever way to make it okay for you to come to work. The police have just installed a new GPS system that actually goes with the individual. And so a woman was heading to work and her child started playing with the button and pushed the panic button. She arrived at work and there was cars everywhere, police vehicles everywhere, and she was just like, oh my gosh. And so we were very happy to hear that, that they had responded in such a way, but it gave her a real sense of I'm okay, I'm safe, so I can leave my home. Because our DVR systems always stayed in the home, so when she left the house, the system wasn't so safe for her. So when we think outside of the box and we provide ways for women to feel safe to travel in their community, and we also, again, about planning, when women leave the shelter, we talk about how are you going to be safe walking from here to, you know, four streets over or five streets over, or how are you going to feel safe going across a bridge to pick up your child from daycare or whatever. So we talk about those things and really try to come up with realistic plans for safety. But when we do that, and as a community responds to how can I support you, how can I make this safe for you, how can we stand with you in this, then the burden is, some of the burden is removed. Because right now, a lot of times the women just struggle day to day, like figuring it out, just figuring it out and not being safe. So when you take those burdens off the woman to have to figure all of that out, then it makes it a much easier for the woman to care for herself, care for her children, and just deal with the emotional impact of the violence that she's endured for the period of time. So I think for us to just realize that, what can we do to make this an easy transition as possible?
So can you repeat the, just remind me of the question?
It's a bad sign. It means I might not have put it very
no, no,
well,
no. Anyway.
I mean, I think the question is, A, what effect does it have on the community itself?
Right.
Not to handle these things well, not to care or protect or pay attention to things that are happening to women within
right.
that community.
Right.
And the converse is, how does a community change, or what does that community feel like when care and protection are extended and are core values of the community?
Right. Well, I think a community that is not addressing sexual violence, I guess there's two pieces to that. One is the exponential increase in terms of the suffering of the people who have experienced it. And the other piece is that it's a culture where there's no consequence for doing that, and so it's kind of open season, which kind of, there's lots of, you know, the consequences that there's lots of space for that to happen, and there's no consequence. So I think, you know, one of the really hard pieces, I mean, there's a lot of hard pieces about this, but I think one of the really hard pieces in terms of really starting to address this is, what are the consequences going to be for folks who perpetrate, right? Oftentimes where, you know, a lot of the focus gets focused on people who are surviving this violence and victims and that sort of thing, and that's very important. But I think a culture that's actually addressing sexual violence is going to have to address that behavior. It's going to, and you know, for intimate partner violence, there's going to have to be some teeth, some consequence for this happening, and so we're going to, that's going to have to happen. Mm. So I think a culture that was sort of progressive about this would be starting to look at that in terms of, and not wanting to demonize people, but to address behaviors, right? Because that's what we're looking at. We're not trying to kind of, you know, just sort of write people off or that kind of thing, but in terms of, all right, so if these behaviors are happening in our community, how can we shift the focus onto those behaviors and how we're going to prevent them or what we're going to do about them when they happen? So I think that's an important piece.
Also, just following up on that, children are extremely impacted by violence in the home. And from our perspective, we're now seeing generational results of that. So we have young children who have witnessed violence with their dad being the perpetrator, and then they then start to mimic or emulate that in their relationships in the community as they go forward and get older. And then we also have young women who are changed forever by the violence in their home and how they behave, what they understand as normal. So we have women who came into the shelter 15, 20 years ago with their young children and who now are coming in as adults who are also involved in intimate partner violence because what they've determined is normal in their relationships continue the cycle. And so they're really the invisible folks in the equation. And so when we look at impacts in our community, how that impacts the children as they grow up and how they interact in the community and their relationships is pivotal to be a part of that conversation. And in our understanding, we have young children who come into the shelter who have taken on a parenting role, really. They've become the protector. They will not leave mom's side because they're fearful mom will be killed if he or she leaves the mom's side. We had one family whose little guy was 5 years old. He refused to go to school. He refused to go to the playroom. He refused to do pretty much anything because he was so terrified. He became the person who saved mom's life one night at home. And so he takes that responsibility very seriously. And so he refused to do a whole lot of stuff. So we tried very hard to work with him to allow him to be a child again. And that's important. But violence, witnessing violence in the home is severely impactful to children, which we don't often see. But when we see the generational impacts and see them starting to come up as abusers and as victims of abuse, we need to understand that there are real concrete issues that will result if we don't address these at the time. And so I think certainly accountability and changing patterns in family for sure is an important part of how we as a community reacts to this issue. Yeah.
It just reminds me of I had this wonderful counselor once whose approach was all around mindfulness, and I remember really struggling with the whole concept of reporting my daughter's father in, you know, being responsible in any way for getting him, you know, in quotation marks, in trouble. And I remember when she said to me once that, you know, that it's just not in anybody's highest good to be able to harm somebody else. And I guess I would apply, and it was very helpful to think about it in that way, and I guess I would apply the same concept to a community, that it's not in the highest good of a community either mm-hmm. to not intervene, that it is in our highest good to help people who need to be helped and to practice kindness.
So I'd like to thank our presenters for a session that was at once inspiring, informative, and heartbreaking. We will, Heather Gaskell, Lori Ehler, and Becky Atkinson, thank you very much. You've given us a really good start and ground to now continue the discussion after a break in the World Cafe, and I think you've given us all a lot to think about and to feel. So thank you very much, and we will take a break now.